The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, I am Avra Lewis with the North Carolina Reading Service, and for the next half hour, I will be reading to you from Essence Magazine. The first article is titled, Notes on Passing, the upcoming drama based on the 1929 novel looks at the cultural self-alienation a Black woman experiences when she attempts to gain the privileges that come with assuming a white identity. When my light-skinned, Black and mixed-race teenage son was little, I worried aloud to my best friend about whether people would recognize him as Black or whether, God forbid, he himself would decide to identify as even partially white. My girlfriend, who is also Black, would counter with, why would he want to be on that team? Seriously, have you seen that team? Yes, I would say, all too much, for far too long. And we would laugh because it was funny-ish. I was adopted by a white family and raised in a primarily white rural New England town. I then spent my life well into adulthood, seeking out Blackness and trying to arrive at a place where I could feel unambiguous in my identity as a Black woman. My son opting to identify as white would have been the opposite of my journey. But as I grew older, I actually stopped worrying that he would be taken as white and became more worried that he would be profiled by the police as Black. The irony. Even if my son could, quote unquote, pass, the concept is absolutely bewildering to him, for which I am exceedingly grateful. My white husband and I, along with our chosen Black family, have raised him to embrace and take pride in his Blackness. And while I'm quite sure that there are many more racial identity conversations to come, at 16 years old, he pretty solidly sees himself as Black. I want that for him because with Blackness comes a mighty legacy. I told him that I'd been asked to write about a movie called Passing, based on a book from the late 1920s, exploring the choice that some light-skinned Black people made, particularly just after slavery was abolished, to assume a white identity, both for their personal safety and for the privileges whiteness afforded. Oh, like Michael Jackson, he asked. That's a different pathology, I said. My son did have a point, though. His response underlined the idea that passing or attempting to pass, whether for safety purposes during Jim Crow America or to survive the white gaze in the 21st century, is a clear-eyed choice to denounce Blackness. And once you make that choice, as Passing's co-protagonist Claire Kendry did, it isn't always easy to live with the burden of that lie. Rebecca Hall, the British actress best known for roles in Vicky Cristina, Barcelona, and The Town, who is of mixed race heritage and who herself appears white, a different ball of wax than Passing, makes her directorial debut with this stunningly deft adaptation of Harlem Renaissance writer Nella Larsen's 1929 novel, Passing. The film stars Ruth Negga as Kendry and Tessa Thompson as Irene Redfield, childhood friends who reunite in adulthood after years of estrangement. The premise of the story is that Kendry and Redfield, both Black, are light-skinned enough to pass as white, which Kendry chooses to do while Redfield, for the most part, remains in her Blackness. Kendry marries a wealthy white businessman, John and has a daughter who attends a boarding school in Switzerland. Residing with her family primarily in Europe, Kendry keeps her true racial identity a secret from both her husband and her daughter. Redfield, meanwhile, marries Brian, a black doctor, has two sons, and serves on charity boards in high society Harlem, where she lives with her family. From a purely aesthetic standpoint, the film, shot in black and white, is an elegantly textured, rigorously restrained masterpiece. Although a reviewer has suggested that Hall chose to shoot in black and white to make it unavoidably clear that both women could pass for white. From the first scene in which Thompson and Nega appear together, and the two immediately registered to me as black. I don't believe that's because I know and am an admirer of their work. I think it's because, as black folks, we somehow always see each other. And this, ultimately, is what makes the choice to pass as depicted through Nega's truly exquisite performance. Not merely a survival mechanism or an act of cultural betrayal, but a horrible underestimation of the power and privilege that blackness affords. Kendra had thought that being white, marrying a wealthy white man, despite his being a blatant racist, and having a white-presenting daughter was all she could ever want. And yet, she longs to be in Redfield's world, in community with black people. Redfield has her own ambitions. She tries to carefully thread the needle between suitable Negro pride and respectable politics, clearly pleased that she can freely be black and keep company with a renowned white male itinerary figure. She does concede with an internal pause that there is perhaps an unspoken connection among black folks. I suppose sometimes there is a thing, she says, watching Kendry on the dance floor at a party for the Negro Welfare League, a thing that cannot be registered. In an interview with Indie Wire Studio earlier this year, Nega described the idea of passing as loss, a severing of the one's past, a severing of oneself, she said. It's a sentiment that resonates with me deeply. It is why I often take issue with transracial adoption, specifically with white parents adopting and raising black children in white environments, as my own parents did. It is why I want my son to be proud and secure in his blackness, because I am forever committed to sparing him the pain of what that kind of severance feels like. Among the film's most affecting achievements is how Hall captures the stubbornly trenchant, rage-inducing frivolity of racism that seeps below the surface before exploding with casual indifference. At the start of the film, just after reconnecting, Kendry and Redfield are catching up in Kendry's hotel room when her husband comes in calling after her, his voice a long, drawn-out baritone. Redfield pulls the brim of her hat down further as Kendry flutters about, greets her husband with a kiss, gets him a drink, and then stands next to his chair to toast to quote-unquote old friends. Kendry lifts her flask, takes a swig, and then brazenly asks Redfield if she'd heard what her husband had called her. Before Redfield can answer, Kendry, her witness fastened on her like an expensive string of pearls, insists her husband explain his pet name for her. When we first married, this woman was as white as a lily, he begins. But as the years go by, she seems to be getting darker and darker. Kendry opens the door to let in a black bellhop before sitting on the arm of her husband's chair to hear the rest of the story. He loops his arm around her waist like a master showing favor to his most prized house slave. And for a minute, you think he knows that Kendry is actually black and gets some kind of perverse kick out of it. And then, without changing a single note in his affable tenor of his explanation, he says, "So I told her, if you don't look out, you'll wake up one morning and find that you've turned into a nigger." Kendry smiles with bright amusement at Redfield, who begins to laugh almost maniacally. Kendry laughs as well, and the two women giggle uncontrollably like the young girls they once were, now with a secret of unfathomable weight. Rebecca Carroll writes about race in America. Her memoir, Surviving the White Gaze, was published earlier this year. Rebecca Carroll wrote this article. This next article is for mature audiences only. 8 Ways to Better Sex. Now that you've returned to the office and the kids are back in school, it's time to return to good times between the sheets with a little help from the experts. We asked a few of our favorite experts for their best tips on turning up the heat. Take notes. Body gratitude. What Howard refers to as a naked homework can help you become more vulnerable with your partner. To prepare for this fun exercise that Howard tells us is believed by sexologists, simply carve out some time alone together, get naked, get comfortable, and unplug from technology. Sit down for at least 10 minutes and just offer gratitude to your partner's different body parts, she says. You might look at your body part and want to give gratitude and say, "I really love how big and strong your arms are because of the way you hold me." Showering each other with heartfelt compliments is key, so be sure the love goes both ways. Take turns going back and forth, giving each other appreciation for your bodies. Howard continues, "You can do this on the bed together, on the floor, or wherever you want." 2 Tickets to Fantasyland. Don't forget the power of fantasy, says Brown James. In other words, don't hide that you enjoy porn or that you fantasize about new positions. Share it. Use those as tools, she says. Like, "Hey, I just read about this really hot thing. Can I try it with you?" Or, "I just saw this really hot thing. Do you want to see it too?" Engage in those things that get you aroused and share them with your lover, because arousal begets arousal. However, she warns, timing is everything when it comes to having a spicy conversation. Avoid bringing them up when you're spending time with extended family or during an argument or when you're just about to have sex. The pressure. Find a low-key moment when you're both feeling relaxed and be direct. Brown James suggests, say, "Hey, we haven't talked about sex in a while. Are you up for it?" Party of 2. Busy couples can sometimes feel as if they're too tired to have sex. Brown James recommends putting your phones aside and trying mutual masturbation. Sit across from your lover on the bed or the couch and watch them pleasure themselves while you're pleasing yourself too, she says. You'll learn some techniques that your lover likes. You'll notice, for example, "Oh, they like to use their thumb in this way," or "Wow, look at their face when they're about to come close." And that can be really hot. Sex doesn't always need to be this overzealous, exhaustive process, Brown James says. You get to take care of yourself, and your lover gets to cheer you on from their own corner, and you do the same for them. Lastly, treat yourself. The more you know about your body, the better you'll perform and feel in bed. Maybe you learned through masturbation that there are other parts of your body you like to be touched, says Francis, a licensed marriage and family therapist who specializes in sex therapy and emotional intelligence. Maybe give yourself a scalp massage or caress your own thighs or your own chest. And don't forget to play with sex toys. Toys do things that human bodies can't, notes Francis. We use tools for all kinds of things. Cars move faster than legs. Forks are more efficient than fingers. Consider what toys might do for you that you can't always do for yourself. The next article is titled, "It's Complicated." COVID-19 Vaccines. changing behavioral guidelines as kids return to class this fall, more than just back-to-school shopping weighs heavy on moms' minds. When it comes to kids and the COVID-19 vaccine, K. Ellie Jones isn't a conspiracy theorist, but a previous experience with mandatory inoculations has made her skeptical. "I do believe something happened to my child when he got two vaccinations very close together," she says from her home in Riverside, California. "We ended up seeing him revert developmentally. To prevent severe illness or hospitalization from the coronavirus, the CDC currently recommends that everyone age 12 and older get a COVID-19 vaccine within the scope of the emergency use authorization. However, Jones isn't convinced that vaccination is the right choice for her 15-year-old DJ as he begins his freshman year of high school. "I don't want my son to get ill as a result of him not being vaccinated," says the director, producer, filmmaker, and brand consultant. "But I would never forgive myself if I did get him vaccinated. And then a year later, we find out all these different types of impacts." Erica, a parenting expert and author of How We Have a Kid and a Life, a Survival Guide, has heard both sides of the debate from moms like Jones. She encourages them to weigh two considerations. Are they more afraid of an unknown, unproven possible risk, describing parents' vaccine fears? Or are they more afraid of the child getting one of the COVID variants and ending up in the hospital? That said, she understands that it can be difficult for families to see the virus as a threat if they haven't experienced anyone getting sick from it. Cynthia Murray has a 16-year-old daughter. Paige has cerebral palsy and asthma. And for Murray, getting her the vaccination was a no-brainer. "My priority as a mother of a special needs child was making sure she was safe," she says. "I was concerned and I wanted her to take the vaccine to be safe when she went back to school." Meanwhile, New York mom Melanie Brissett hopes the city won't require students to be vaccinated. She has doubts based on how quickly the vaccines came to market. Brissett understands the argument that the technology used was under development for years and knows the vaccines underwent rigorous testing protocols. But she isn't reassured. "I believe it required more time, but I know we were in a dire situation to find a solution to reduce the number of deaths." Still, the mom of three and her husband are 85% sure they would vaccinate their kids if push came to shove, or figure out a remote learning alternative. Shots aside, her biggest concern is convincing her 8-year-old son, Jason, who was obsessed with pandemic news reports that it is safe to resume outdoor sports. One too many images of freezers storing dead bodies left him shaken. He now refuses to play football with his team and prefers the virtual universe of Roblox. "I'm unhappy that we have to drag him outside," says Brissett, founder of Brooklyn Watt, a women's empowerment group. He cries, "Mom, can I just stay home?" Brissett did finally convince him to take swim classes. If Jason's behavior seems extreme, she affirms that it is normal, especially after being in a protective bubble for so long. However, she challenges parents to create opportunities for kids to comfortably engage with peers. She also recommends that parents communicate openly and effectively with teachers and coaches about testing, mask policies and other safety protocols. We know kids perform better and have better outcomes when they participate in activities and clubs and are socialized, she explains, adding that sports and extracurricular activities teach valuable skills like teamwork and compromise. During the pandemic, both Brissett's and Jones's kids escaped into electronic devices. Pulling kids away from online gaming and tablets is crucial to getting them reacclimated to the classroom. After a year and a half of remote learning, students around the country are being forced to play a wicked game of catch-up. That's why Salter urges parents to make sure everything is in place at the start of the year, especially for students with an individualized education plan, IEP. If you haven't been approved for services, if you weren't assigned a speech pathologist, reading specialist, or whatever your kid needs, now's the time to lobby to make sure those things will be put in place for your child, Salter says. Brissett and Jones are already on it. Jason's school schedule a soft launch with activities to help students adjust to new classroom layouts and to relieve any PTSD. And before DJ graduated from middle school, the Joneses family had a meeting with administrators and DJ support team at his new high school. While DJ is now eager to return to school, a few months ago, he wasn't feeling it. He's excited about taking video production as one of his classes, and for the docuseries I do for my branding agency, he's one of the producers and helps me run things on set, Jones says with pride of his work on Beauty Behind the Brand live docuseries. I think all this will make it easier for him to go back to school in the fall. The next article is called Risk Factor. After losing her mother to breast cancer, Jen Hayes Lee closely monitored her own breast health. She's preparing for a double mastectomy after a positive genetic test result. Jen Hayes Lee and her best girlfriends agreed they were done having babies and toyed with the idea of getting mommy makeovers. It was a lighthearted kiki for Lee. Getting snatched triggered a sobering thought. I need to do testing. She wanted to know if anything in her genetic makeup would indicate a need for something much more serious, like a mastectomy. Lee's mother, Irma J. Bland, MD, was diagnosed with breast cancer at 39, the age Lee is now. She was in remission for 11 years after treatment, but when she was 50, the disease resurfaced and Dr. Bland died 5 years later. Lee was 21. Her aunt had breast cancer too, and her dad died of prostate cancer in 2018. Given her family medical history, Lee was proactive about her breast health. I started getting mammograms because I've heard you are supposed to start them 5 or 10 years earlier before the age that the person in your family was diagnosed, she says from her home in New Jersey. But for me, it was sort of start and stop because for the last 6 years, I've been pregnant or breastfeeding. At the beginning of this year, the married mom of three tested positive for a mutation in the breast cancer 2 gene, commonly known as BRCA2. According to the National Cancer Institute, NCI, both BRCA1 and BRCA2 impact a woman's chance of developing specific cancers, including breast, ovarian, and pancreatic. NCI data reported that 45 to 69% of women who inherit a harmful BRCA2 variant will develop breast cancer by age 70 to 80. Knowing that Black women die from breast cancer at a much higher rate than white women, Lee carefully weighed her options, which included frequent risk monitoring via a combination of mammograms, ultrasounds, and magnetic resonance imaging, MRI. She ultimately chose the most aggressive path, a double mastectomy. Based on her age, family history, and role as a mom to young children, Her doctors agreed this was the strongest prevention plan for her. Lee wasn't prepared for the wave of emotions that would come with this decision. The idea of removing a body part tied to her femininity and identity as a curvy black woman was unexpectedly hard, she admits. There was so much to consider, like choosing a surgical oncologist and a plastic surgeon who would work together, in addition to issues of cost, insurance coverage, and recovery time while balancing work and family. After reading first-person essays and watching videos from women who had the procedure, Lee went back and forth between confidence and doubt. Then the marketing executive had lunch with two women with personal histories of breast cancer. Hearing their stories of fighting the disease changed everything. I was feeling guilty for feeling sorry for myself, she recalls. I had the option of breast cancer prevention while they actually battled cancer. I had the opportunity to approach it another way. That was a privilege, a gift. I realized I had to reframe my thinking. Because Lee has chosen mastectomy surgery without having cancer, she's pursuing a path with the most natural-looking outcome. Her doctors have recommended a multi-step procedure beginning in August and spanning 9 months. The surgeries will begin with a breast reduction and lift to allow for an optimal nipple sparing reconstruction. Next, Jen will undergo a preventative double mastectomy and phase one of the reconstruction procedure. Then she'll have a breast implant transfer, which is the final phase, and will return her girls to her pre-surgery 36 double D status. I wouldn't know what to do with an A cup, Lee laughs. Her husband, Clyde, supports her decision, which is a relief but not a surprise. His own mother died when he was 11 years old. As with any procedure, there's infection risk, but Lee's focused on the positive. Once this is done, I'm not going to have to wonder every year with every mammogram if this time they are going to find something. The next article is titled, Meet the Real Life Figures Depicted in the Black Western, The Harder They Fall. Netflix's highly anticipated The Harder They Fall puts a new twist on the Old West. Written, directed, and scored by J. Miss Samuel, this movie highlights a moment in history and shows that cowboys came in different forms, contrary to popular belief. The film tells the story of Nate Love, an outlaw bent on avenging the death of his parents, who were murdered in cold blood by Rufus Buck. After Buck was broken out of prison by his gang, The Harder They Fall follows the battle between the two groups led by Love and Buck, along with providing the audience an action-packed journey backed by an amazing soundtrack. The Harder They Fall premieres on Netflix in November. While the story told in the all-black Western is entirely fictional, many of its characters were actual figures, such as Nate Love, who was born into slavery in 1854. After the Civil War, his family was freed and began working on plantations in and around Davidson County, Tennessee. Nat's father passed away when he was 15 years old. During his time in Tennessee, Nate became skilled at cattle punching and raised enough money to go out on his own at the age of 16.
Well, we have run out of time for today's episode of Essence. We hope you enjoyed it and be sure to listen next time. I am Ava Lewis, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Essence is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call us at 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.